All right, come on.
Mommy would be so mad at me.
No, she wouldn't.
No, Mama doesn't listen to the show, so we're good.
Listen to the show. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Oppenheimer. Sometimes my dad and his friends say really bad words. So if you don't want to listen to bad words, then you should get the hell out of here.
Yeah! We're using this every week.
Hello, Jews and everyone else. This is Unorthodox. I am Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello, we made it from the wilderness to almost the Holy Land.
Almost. And senior writer Leah Leibowitz.
Happy eighth day of the Omer.
The Omer is just the days between the Passover and Shavuot, right?
50 days.
50 days.
It's sort of like our Lent a little bit.
It is kind of like Lent.
And you can't
it?
Cut your hair. You can't get married, right?
There must be
there's 3 weeks you
ways
can't get married.
To count the Omer.
Our Jew of the week is filmmaker Fern Perlstein, director of The Last Laugh, which is a documentary about Holocaust humor. It's like she was the guest made for made for us.
It's like, thank you for making this documentary, so now we can have you on the show.
And our Gatwa, our Gentile of the week, is Ashley McKinless, host of Jesuitical, a podcast that's like the Catholic Unorthodox, except they're even younger than we are.
But it really is the Catholic Unorthodox.
It really is the Catholic.
I'd say it's a pretty good like theological theory. At first, there was the original Jewish podcast, right?
Oh, that was my joke. Gonna make to
and
her.
Then someone's like, you know what? We can do the same
thing. We're
gonna
be new,
a little
only
different.
Way more popular.
Yes, all the things that we don't really like about it.
So what's up, Jews? A little Passover recap.
I love Passover. Feel terrible after the Seders, though. But like
the wine?
No, like the matzah, the chopped liver. It's like you just feel
it's
very
heavy for you.
It's heavy.
It's heavy. Yeah.
It's heavy for everyone, I think.
I don't end up eating so much at the Seders because I'm leading them. Like I'm not going back.
How was your leadership this year? What's your job approval rating after this?
I feel like my leadership was strong. I feel like there was general consensus, at least by which I mean Sid agreed with me, that the second night was really strong. I mean, we had wonderful Seders both nights.
Was the second night the one without the family?
Is no, there was actually more family. Actually, that was the night that my parents and sister joined us. But my sister brought her friend Cheshire. My cousin Sasha brought her friend Hopewell. Mm-hmm. So we had people at our Seder named Cheshire and Hopewell, and they were amazing. And then we had a Zelda, and Zelda was
amazing.
Important. And then we had Hannah, who's this new, amazingly wonderful midwife who's moved to the neighborhood. I mean, I don't know if her midwifery skills are good, but she's a great person. The thing about guests is that they're usually awesome. I mean, my family's awesome too, but we had like 4 or 5 people who were there who were grateful to have been invited to a Seder. I think Hopewell had never been to one before. And
yeah, they want
to
bring it.
And they bring it. And it was just really, it was really wonderful.
Because it's what you said last time. It's the opposite, basically, of people being like, oh, this is the Seder. We're going to just like go through it. If you have new people, they actually are interested. And they're almost the ideal participants.
Totally.
See, my leadership.
Yeah, how was your leadership?
My Sedership style. I would say it was kind of Trumpian. So a lot
sounds
of
right.
A lot of overconfidence at the top, not a lot of skill. And then like a whole cabinet of whom, like, let's say 3 or 4 are like great, like Nikki Haley types that you really want there and trust and love. And then there's sort of like, oh, wow, that person's just like really doing
a lot of
like their own thing.
It's like
a lot of divisiveness. No, I'm kidding.
Devosiveness.
Devosiveness.
Nice. Mark's pun. Yeah. Mark's second pun of 2017. Everyone drink.
Can we talk about Passover lingo?
Yes. I'm just so curious because I got a lot of Zissen Pesachs and I was like, okay. And then a lot of like Chag Sameach, which I mean, I prefer a happy Passover. Just
right.
Like,
just I just want to say, I
do you
say,
live in Krakow and or Petach Tikva? Because right. If the answer is yes,
but I was
those
just so curious, like, who says what?
Terms.
All right. When I was growing up, it was like happy Passover. And then I discovered in college this Chag Sameach thing, but I still to this day can't remember what's a Chag and what's not. Because the Yontefs aren't like, Rosh Hashanah is not a Chag, right? Chags are. There's like 5 or 6.
Are like the happy ones, right?
Are the happy ones, right?
Because it's like.
And then I'm just barely getting why they say in the middle. So for our listeners who don't know, that's like joyous holiday, Chag Sameach, right? But then in the middle of it, they'll say Moedim L'Simcha, which means like it's the middle of something, right? But it has spread. And Sid, I will say, is really bothered. It's like one of her pet peeves are people who don't know a word of Hebrew who have to say Chag Sameach instead of just like. Yeah, and it's like there's been a creep of look how OG I am, in the holiday wishes.
I mean, Chag Sameach to me is very, like, Hamish. Like, it seems, oh, Chag Sameach. Like, it depends how you, you know, you hug someone for the Seder, oh, Chag Sameach.
Although, I agree.
What's this in Pesach? Where did
it's
that come
sweet,
from?
Right, sweet Pesach, which I learned from a PJ Library book, which where they talk about.
And they did not pay to say that.
They did not pay me to say that, but they, like the Bubby and the Zadie say, have a zis in Pesach.
So that's the Yiddish version that your Bubby and Zadie would say. Yeah.
But, except my Bubby and Zadie said, like, they called up, they're like, hey, did you have a Seder?
Yo.
Like, yo. Like.
But so why are all like the young saying it now?
They're culturally appropriating Judaism. They're so un-Jewish that they have to culturally appropriate. I think this is what it is.
Well, part of it.
If you have nothing, you go to silly words like, oh, I know the term.
Part of it is the state of Israel, right? Like, that's when they shifted. And like, we have to say Shabbat Shalom because we're teaching the kids Hebrew. And that's, I think, where – that's why it's surprising that Shul and Zis and Pesach have come back because they're old Yiddishism. So that's like
– right, because – you know why, Mark? Because of the occupation.
Is that why?
If you say Chag Sameach – then you support Bibi Netanyahu, so you have to say Yiddish, which is socialist.
Is that a real theory?
You know, I'm going with that.
You're going?
That sounds – there has to be
– So you won't say Zis and Pesach.
It's like a left-wing activist movement underground.
There has to be some dickwad in Brooklyn who's like, I don't feel comfortable using Hebrew because it's the language of the oppressor, so I'm going to go back to Yiddish because it's the language of the Holocaust.
I mean, you should just go back to Aramaic at that point.
I do have
– Mel Gibson claimed that.
But he takes all the good things.
He does take all the good things. Anyway, everyone, we hope you had a Zis in Pesach. And
Chag Sameach.
And you know what you missed if you were Zisening your Pesach? If you were really frum about Zisening your Pesach, is you missed Sean Spicer talking about concentration camps or death camps as Holocaust centers.
I have never regretted agreeing to take a week off of this podcast for, like, you know, Passover, which seemed legitimate. And it was sort of like, what's the worst that could happen? No one's doing anything.
There'll be no big
literally
Jew
the
news.
Second day of Passover.
No. The first.
Oh, the first.
It was
the second
Tuesday.
Seder.
It was
Sorry,
the day
second,
of the second.
The day
it was,
of the second
it was
Seder.
The first full 24 hours of Passover.
Spicy.
Can
really
I just say how much I love the locution Holocaust Center? Because, of course, the first thing that I think about is like an offshore call center. And it's like, oh, hello, welcome to Holocaust Center. It's like, you guys don't sound German. Like, no, my name is Dietrich. We're totally German. How could we help you with your mass execution today? It's like,
so your idea is they were offshoring the murder of Jews
somewhere
to Mumbai.
In Bangalore, there's like a bunch of dudes being like, this is a really good job. Because you know the Germans would not do it. Like, that's a shitty job. The Germans, like, build cars.
To me, a Holocaust center is like these amazing Holocaust museums that exist around the world. And I was like, you know, Follow Friday, a bunch of Holocaust centers.
To me,
like,
the Holocaust center is something my parents are on the board of seven of.
And to me, of course, the Holocaust Center was like a Jewish community center, but you don't have to pay a membership fee, and there are no squash courts, and they're slightly better heated.
Why are you assuming that you don't have to pay? Of course you have to pay.
It's like, well,
for the Holocaust Center, it's $10,000 for the basic membership. That does not include the pool. You know, it's going to be that. What kills me is that a whole host of people who fervently supported a big, big, big deal with an actual Holocaust-denying regime that spends millions and hundreds of millions of dollars killing actual Jews were like, oh my God, he said Holocaust centers. Could you believe how ignorant this regime is?
I assume you're talking about the Iran deal here?
You know, guys, if you cared so much about Jews and the Holocaust, maybe go easy on supporting the regime that actually kind
this
of
is the,
into the Holocaust.
This is the month where you're anti-Trump.
Oh.
This is Liel's.
Wait until you hear my Mazel Tov.
You're still anti-Trump, right?
You know who's getting my Mazel Tov.
This is his Omar.
I just want to check. Are you still anti-Trump?
Forever, but...
But
you know,
now you're anti-anti-Trump.
But you're anti-hypocrisy,
I'm
basically.
Anti-everything.
You're anti-everything.
I'm just anti.
Okay, so bringing the news up to date, this from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, the Orthodox Jewish mayoral candidate in some town in England.
Whose name is?
Shneur Odza.
Say it again.
It's Shneur Odza.
It's like Shmura Matza, but like the next level of
that's
it.
That's exactly right.
Anyway, he's weirdly enough a candidate for UKIP, for the right-wing populist party, the UK Independence Party. On the eve of Pesach, he found a Hebrew language New Testament, which had been produced by some sort of Jews for Jesus or just Jesus's for Jesus group. And he found in his synagogue, he found this New Testament and he took it out in the street and set it on fire and took a picture and tweeted it, writing under the picture, grateful to whoever put a missionary Bible amongst our synagogue's books, was wondering what I'd burn my chametz with.
So salty.
Dang,
I gotta
Schneer.
Tell you, Schneer, I'm kind of feeling that, brother. I love burning books, but like, that's funny. And every time Jews misbehave in like a really colossal way, I'm like, you know what? Yeah, these are my people.
It's kind of like file under like not great for the Jews in the UK, right. Like who are already like, you know, dealing with some stuff for your not that he represents all Jews, but kind of now he does, right?
Yeah, but you know what? I would rather that the labor fuckers who are like, well, Jews are like, you know what? Know that there are people like Schneer out there who would burn
Schneer,
shit up.
Right. Schneer will cut you.
Yeah. You want to fuck with the Jews? There's a Schneer motherfucking Odze out there who has a lighter and a license to use it.
Oh my.
Yeah.
And then of course, I don't even know what to say about this. There were flyers in the streets of Brooklyn. I'm just titling that just so we can get the Smith song
the
in there.
Smith song ever.
That some guy like drove through Borough Park or Williamsburg or whatever, like threw flyers with anti-Semitic things
on them.
He was
on a motorcycle.
He was on a motorcycle. He was like the anti-Semitic bandit of Dumbo.
But it's like a reverse bandit.
Anyway,
he's
a coward, and if they ever catch him, they're going to fly him
what
over
was
to
in
Schneer
the
flyers were really gross. They had a lot of Holocaust denial. They had like swastikas. They had cartoons about the Holocaust myth and like how long can Jews control the everything? And then it's like not long. Answer: not long. And just like gross drawings.
Well, Jewish Voices for Peace. Congratulations on your latest campaign in Brooklyn.
I just feel like we talk about, you know, we're like, okay, the JCC wasn't really what we thought it was. But like for all the like fear that was sort of assuaged when we found out the JCC bombing suspect wasn't actually going to do anything, you're like, there's still this like nasty undercurrent of anti-Semitism. I think I've gone into the alarmist party, by the
way. Look at that.
It just took one, two passive crusades.
So you're in the alarmist party. Liel's in the anti-Trump party.
Well, no, I'm with her in the alarmist too.
Okay.
It's actually # I'm with her.
I'm with her.
Can I talk about an upcoming live show?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I would like to do the same thing.
The live show is Moi. No, it's not really me, but the storytelling and narrative journalism conference that I've helped put together at Yale for the past 2 years is happening again, June 11th through 14th. It's called Thread. You can find out more at thread.yale.edu. The faculty is unbelievable. It's Catherine Burns from The Moth. It's Glenn Washington
from
Snap.
Amazing.
It's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. It's Sarah Stillman from The New Yorker. It's Linda Gradstein from formerly the Jerusalem Bureau Chief of NPR. It's me. It's Nicole Hannah-Jones from The Times Magazine and This American Life. It's just a great – oh, Steve Brodner, the cartoonist. Actually, he does this amazing thing. He teaches everyone how to cartoon in like 3 minutes. Anyway, if you want to know more, go to thread.yale.edu and yeah, we'd love to see you.
But that's all the way in the summer.
But that's in June.
No, do you have something for us soon?
What you got?
Our listeners do not have that kind of attention span, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I've already forgotten.
This coming Monday.
Yes.
This Monday.
April 24th, right? 24th at 6:30 p.m. at Yeshiva University Museum, which is at the Center for Jewish History on,
downtown.
I believe, 15th Street.
I think 16th.
16th Street. Yours truly will be leading a gallery walk and talk about Jerusalem and my family's history.
But
and
you've
role
never been there.
The city to which you've probably been.
Well, you
been
know, I watched
twice.
Some YouTube videos. I read Mark Twain. He was there some years back. And it was. This is going to be about my anti-Zionist great-grandfather, who was a famous rabbi who felt you could only be a true anti-Zionist if you lived in Jerusalem.
Lordy.
That is like deep.
Lordy.
That is so, that is you. That is anti-anti-anti.
That is anti-anti-anti.
You know what we're pro is our subscribers to our newsletter. You can get our newsletter by writing to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or just going on our website and clicking our newslettery button. This week, we'd like to welcome the new subscribers. They constitute the law firm of Michaela Brown, Michelle Skalrud, and Yonadav Tapuchi.
It's pronounced Tapuchi.
Who is Yonadav Tapuchi?
Like, Liel seems to know him.
Liel, were you in the IDF with Yonadav Tapuchi?
That's such a good
and
name.
And what was he known as then?
Yonadav Tapuchi was not in the IDF. Yonadav Tapuchi was born John Smith in a small town in Wisconsin before he saw the light. He moved to the West Bank. He started his own settlement called Tapuach, and he changed his name to Yonadav Tapuchi. He's a famous settler rabbi leader right now.
What is Yonadav? It's not Yonatan.
No.
What is it? What is
it's
it?
It's the next step.
It's what you call Nadav when you see him passing on the other side of the street.
Yo!
Mark, that was a funny joke.
You guys have learned me in this stuff. I'm getting...
But what is Yonadav? Is that a common name in Israel?
No, it is not.
I like it a lot.
So yeah, get the newsletter. Also, recommend us to a friend. If every one of you brought in one new listener, the increased...
Mashiach would come.
It would be as if you brought in the full universe of subscribers.
What I was going to say, a little more down to earth and homely, was that our increased ad revenue would allow me to send my children to Jewish summer camp, thus keeping them within the fold, thus thwarting Hitler.
Wow.
So how about that?
Speaking of Hitler,
in two steps.
Yeah.
What's the date this Friday?
420?
It is 420.
Why is that a Hitler thing?
Because that's his birthday.
Wait, 420?
What kind of a Jew are you?
420 is pot day and Hitler's birthday?
Yeah.
Obviously.
I didn't know.
It's the yin and the yang.
Oh, my God.
So I'm reading the new Hitler biography.
You've been reading it for a while.
Yeah, what's
pal.
Taking
it's
so long?
It's 1,000 pages.
How does it end?
That dude, I don't know. I'm really surprised. I think he's going back to being an artist. There are a lot of good signs there. But the thing that I love the most is that there is literally a chapter in this biography, the title of which, I'm not making this up, is Hitler and the Ladies, which is about Hitler's romantic love life. But I'm thinking this is the worst season of The Bachelor ever. Uh-huh. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry, you all get a rose except for you, Vera Cohen. Yeah, you are not getting the rose. There will be a train to escort you back.
I'm surprised it hasn't been done.
I have no idea what's in his head. It would suck if I went home on the first night just because he didn't really get a chance to get to know me.
Our Jewish guest is filmmaker Fern Perlstein, whose new documentary is The Last Laugh, which explores the thorny question of can we joke about the Holocaust and who, if anyone, is allowed to tell those jokes. Welcome, Fern.
Thank you for having me.
Hello.
Hi.
So why take on this topic?
Yeah, good question. Really good question. Boy, it dates pretty far back, actually. In 1990, a very good friend of mine and I went to what was then the brand new Holocaust Memorial in Miami Beach. And we met a survivor who was giving us a tour. And after the tour was up, we had just read Art Spiegelman's Mouse and had been so taken by it. And we started talking to her about it, and she was really upset. She hadn't read it, but her response was, there's nothing funny about the Holocaust. You can't, you know, make humor out of it. And, you know, we had a very thoughtful conversation saying we didn't think that that's, you know, that it was necessarily humor. It was a comic form. And, you know, it was very, you know, like I said, thoughtful conversation. But we sort of went off in our own direction. I went off to film school. My friend went off to get his PhD. And he was thinking about this issue, like, can you make jokes? Did it exist? And he did this 25-page paper called The Last Laugh, Humor in the Holocaust. And it examined this issue, like, within the camps, within the ghettos. And he found, you know, these collections of jokes and stuff. And it was a very academic paper. And I saw him again in 1993, and he handed it to me, and he said, make this into a film. So that's
and
the
here
genesis.
We are.
And here we are. And it only took me until 2011 to raise the money for this difficult
what
project
is the,
to fund.
Here's my question. You know, this is a very Hollywood question. What's the fundraising pitch like? Okay, so get this, Holocaust funny.
Yeah, no, it didn't work. It didn't work. I couldn't get grants to support me. In the end, it was one person.
It was just because the subject is so taboo still?
Yes.
It was at the time?
It was at the time because, you know, So that was 1993, but it wasn't really until 1998. You know, I had met my he became my husband. He hired me to shoot his film. I was a cinematographer, and we immediately, within 3 days, were like planning our life together, turning that paper into a proposal. But we could not get anybody. People were interested. They were fascinated. Producers, sometimes, you know, if we came across, you know, a comedian or anybody with money, they'd be like, great idea. Let me know if somebody else says yes.
Right. But why did it take so long? Because you would think, you know, The Producers was a big hit on Broadway. That kind of skirts the issue a little bit. It's not like there has been absolutely no.
Exactly. Because my, unlike the original paper, my film really was post-war humor. So when I told people what the film was about, they'd blanch. But the fact is, a lot of these examples in the film, they've seen. Everybody has their distinctions, right? I mean, Mel Brooks, who we think of as breaking taboos his entire career, will make fun of the Nazis, but he absolutely draws a line and will not make jokes about the victims or the camps or whatever. Then there are, like, Gilbert Gottfried is like, well, this is an outtake, but he's like, he couldn't understand how comedians had this distinction. She's like, yeah, because the Nazis had nothing to do with the Holocaust.
Unsurprisingly, I'm with St. Gilbert on this one.
What, you think all jokes are okay?
If it's a funny joke, it's a funny joke.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's
well,
like...
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, no, you go.
No, I was just going to say, that is the one thing that everybody agrees on in the film. It's the one point that it has to be funny. But I also think there's intention has to be good, too.
So basically, my grandparents met in the displaced persons camp at Bergen-Belsen. They were in the theater troupe.
Yes. That,
and that's a part of the film. And these theater troupes during and especially after the war, what they did was make fun of the Nazis. And so it's like, to me, there's something very, very, very Jewish and very much at the core of Jewish resistance and survival for millennia that is gallows humor. Like, to me, that is how I imagine my grandparents got through even being in the displaced persons camp, which was not a fun place to be. And so I don't know, for me, there's something so important about that and so actually empowering about that, to say that, like, right after the Holocaust, you could, if you were in those camps, you could find something, if not humorous about it, but you could sort of take back your agency.
Right, great, great stand-up comedy. Do you ever notice typhus? What's up with that?
But I think that's how I imagine in those camps, like, you had to create a world for yourself that was entertaining, that sort of helped you survive.
Yes.
So to me, it's so funny to say, like, and maybe I'm saying this and I can say this as the grandchild of survivors. Like, maybe that's, I don't know.
Well, you know, so Renee Firestone is the survivor in the film who's turning 93 on April 13th. She's become sort of like a grandmother to me. And we have had really incredible conversations exactly about what you're saying. You know, could there have been humor in Auschwitz, for instance? What Renee and I talk about a lot is, you know, people were living their daily lives. A lot of them came from, you know, the ghetto, came from total hatred and being spit upon. And, you know, like, this was another day. You know, it wasn't necessarily the day they knew they were going to their death. And laughter is an instinct. And Renee literally said, you know, if something's funny, you laugh. Even if you were in the camp, if something was funny, you would laugh. I mean, it's hard to imagine that, but it happened.
She's, I think, one of the most interesting parts of the film because she's almost the barometer. Like, she's the survivor there that you see. And so she actually tells what I think is this, it's not hilarious, but she tells this joke about Mengele.
Yeah.
Basically telling her, right, if you survive this, get your tonsils out. Yeah. And she's like, and I survived and I got my tonsils out. And she's laughing. And
actually,
like,
she never did get her tonsils out. Nope.
She's
probably
still not
as a screw
to
you to
yeah.
him.
And it's like, you're literally laughing about something that Mengele told you in a life or death moment. And then, of course, there's a scene of her watching. It's her and her daughter, and her daughter's playing her all these clips of Sarah Silverman making jokes and all these comedians. And she's like, not funny, not funny. So it's like, it's very fascinating to watch her.
Right. But because that's the whole thing, it's not a black and white issue. You know, it's and what she was saying is basically, I'm not offended. It's just not funny. When Lisa Lampanelli told her joke, she was offended. You know, there
because
was
she
a
wasn't
difference.
Jewish?
No, I think it crossed a line. Was it because she wasn't Jewish? Was it a little bit of a, I don't know.
Was there anything while making the film, any joke or anything that you've heard that made you feel uncomfortable?
Well, let me answer that by telling you about my line. You know, like I've noticed, you know, everybody has a line. We see it in the film with Mel Brooks. We see, you know, Susie Essman, her line is, you know, jokes about rape and child molestation. I mean, Gilbert Gottfried, no line, but he's
bless
his own.
Him.
But, you know, my line were those jokes that you heard, like, maybe on a playground or something, those really awful, awful jokes, like, what's the difference between a pizza and a Jew? You know those jokes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
That's my childhood, right?
Yeah.
There.
Wait,
exactly.
What's the answer?
That the pizza does not scream in the oven.
Oh.
You know that.
You know, so that's punching down,
so that's,
is that what they call that?
Yes. And not only that, but there
it's
are,
a very popular joke growing
that's
up.
That's one of the ones I can tell. I mean, they are really awful, awful jokes. And I just felt like, that doesn't make the point of the film. Although we did have a scene where Renee and Claire, just like they are. Claire had found this website with all these jokes. It was just like one really nasty site, you know, that had them all in discussion groups after. And they're reading them, and I can't really see the screen. I just see the back of their heads. I'm trying to. So they're reading the jokes, and one's nastier than the next. And then all of a sudden, the two of them bust out laughing when they get to the bottom. And Renee reads it, and it's, "Why did Hitler really commit suicide? He got the gas bill." But when you hear an Auschwitz survivor laughing at that joke, it's it's, you know, then it becomes funny. But I still, you know, that would have saved the scene because she delivered the joke. But I just thought that, you know, I was trying to make the point that there are all these different factors. There's context, who's your audience, who can tell the joke, you know, and that just didn't like fall into the that just fell in the mean-spirited category for me. But I also wanted to, you know, like by having them watch those jokes on YouTube, I wanted to show that, you know, you could be laughing at that Sarah Silverman joke, and then you widen out and you see Renee look, you know, watching that joke. Suddenly, it doesn't feel that good. And when I would show Rough Cuts early days, I'd have friends say, you take her out saying it's not funny. And I'd say, why? And they say, well, they're ruining. It's like they're making. She's making me feel bad. Oh, you know, she's taking away my
point.
Yeah, exactly. So that just made me stronger. I'm like, I'm holding on to that. But you know, Bob, my husband and I, we went to see, like 15 years ago, we went to see Sarah Silverman do that show, Jesus is Magic, before they filmed it and everything. And you know, we were in a dark theater on Bleecker Street, a lot of young people, everybody laughing. You know, nobody's watching us, you know, laughing. And it was very funny. And then the same jokes when I had her, and I didn't know this was going to happen, but when I watched, when I'm filming her, because I'm holding the camera, you know, and watching those jokes, suddenly I felt sick to my stomach. And that's the roller coaster I wanted the audience to feel.
Well, thank you so much.
Where can our listeners see your film?
On April 24th, it will be on PBS's Independent Lens.
Oh, wow. So our listeners can tune in just in time for Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Yes, exactly. Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Thank you so much, Vern.
Thank you.
Make them laugh. Make them laugh. Make them laugh.
So we've got a special treat today. We've got Noam Osband in the studio with us. He is our resident ukulele genius and friend. Welcome, Noam.
Our UG, our rug.
Resident ukulele. Yeah, he's our rug.
So good to be here. So good to be here. It's going to be an educational song.
Yeah.
But before we get into the education, what did you, how was your Seder? What was like the big thing which you had at your Seder? What was like the main dish? Like what was the main course?
Oh, like seven kinds of meat.
Yeah, we did like a skirt steak my cousin grilled.
Cool.
It was really good.
Was there chicken as well?
Or? But yeah, there was always chicken. But I never actually go for the chicken because there's like so many more exciting types of meat.
That's right.
Cool.
And we do a vegetarian Seder. So
really?
Yeah. So there's a flourless chocolate cake. There's vegetarian. There's matzo lasagna. There's a eggplant.
Tofurkey. Okay.
No, we don't do fake meats because they're terrible.
So by the end of the song, two of you should feel bad about yourself, and one of you is going to feel good about yourself.
Is it Mark?
It's pretty much how life
Mark
goes.
Mark going to be smug because he's a vegetarian.
So we're coming up on a birthday. We're coming up on a birthday. As everybody knows, one of the great coincidences of life is 420 is every great stoner's favorite day. Also, Hitler's birthday. Sean Spicer said about Hitler that he didn't gas his own people, right? And that's crazy. What a horrible thing to say. As if the Jews are not constructed as part of German identity. Horrible. However, I think it's important in this day and age that we do try to see the good in everybody, right? I mean, like, the world has gone to a crazy place, and the only way in which we can really be good is if we recognize everybody has a little bit of good to them.
For sure.
Hitler didn't not gas his people. He gassed his people. But there is something Hitler did not do. Hitler the vegetarian committed acts of genocide. But guess where you never find him? Eating greasy chicken fried. Oh, Hitler the vegetarian did a lot of bad things, but eating hamburgers was not one of his sins. Oh, he believed in the master.
race, but never put a chicken nugget on his plate. Crimes against humanity, but at least he never ate a BLT. True Hitler facts, true Hitler facts. He would sit at the table during mealtimes and say to everybody else who was eating meat, he would say to the leading Nazi officials and the SS men how disgusting it was that they were eating meat, that if they had ever seen a slaughterhouse and the cruelty that goes on in there, they would never eat meat, unlike Leo and Stephanie. Hitler the vegetarian opposed animal cruelty. In that sense, you might say we all share Hitler's ideology. Oh, Hitler the vegetarian, trying to live a good life too. If you oppose factory farming, there's a little bit of Hitler in you. Oh, he believed in the master race, but never put a Polish sausage on his plate. Crimes against humanity, but at least he never ate a manatee. Another Hitler fact, he would apparently cover his eyes during movies when there were scenes of animal cruelty, and he would have somebody tell him when the scene was over so that he could watch it again. That's actually totally true. Hitler the vegetarian couldn't pull the vegan act. Everybody knows Adolf loved omelets, a well-known historical fact. But he only killed one species when he could have been a multi-species killer. 'Cause if you eat beef and chicken, then you're twice a species killer than Hitler. Because he believed in the master race, but never put a chicken nugget on his plate. Crimes against humanity, but at least he never ate at KFC. Hitler the vegetarian.
Yeah!
I have to say that song makes me really sad. So Noam, how do we like find out where we can see you, where we can watch you, where we can hear you?
So when your name is Noam Osband, it's pretty easy to get www.noamosband.com. And if you go there, you can see I'm going to be playing some shows in New York at the end of April and beginning of May. And I'll be doing some of these songs and some new songs as well.
Go Daddy.
Okay, our Gentile of the Week is Ashley McKinless. She is an associate editor at America Magazine, the Jesuit Review of Faith and Culture, and she is co-host of the podcast Jesuitical, which is the Catholic Unorthodox.
Yes, it basically is.
Welcome. We're happy to have you. Let's talk about the pronunciation of Jesuitical. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay, because I heard you say it on your podcast, and then I said, say that the same way on our podcast, because I was going to say Jesuitical.
Jesuitical.
And you would have shown yourself to be such a Jew.
I know. It's like, was it obvious already?
The Catholics would be like, she's such a Jew.
No, but great to be here. It really is that we were inspired by Unorthodox. So,
and here's a great moment to say, everyone listening to this podcast right now,
yeah,
take a moment,
subscribe.
Pause, subscribe
to Jesuitical.
Exactly right.
Yeah, like how many? You guys are in the thousands already.
Yes,
we want to like quadruple you.
Thousands.
We can double that.
That would be awesome.
So when did the podcast start?
It started on Ash Wednesday, so 40 days and some change ago. So we started at the beginning of the season of Lent, which kind of threw us off. The original inspiration from the show came from like bar conversations with my colleagues. We would be in Cassidy's, our local Irish pub, and be talking about like Planned Parenthood and abortion, or like the latest papal encyclical, and just like look around and be
over
like
beers.
As good narcissists, we're like, we should publish this.
So the first one was
this
Ash Wednesday.
This is interesting to everyone.
So you couldn't drink.
Yeah. So the original idea was a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. And then we started on Ash Wednesday. And
wait, you can't drink on Ash Wednesday?
No, you're supposed to. This is the one day of the year where we actually fast. Like, I know Catholics generally get the rap for like fake fasting.
Wait, so Ash Wednesday, you don't... Really? Catholics don't eat on Ash Wednesday?
But your fasting is morning to sundown, right?
Yeah.
It's a Muslim fast?
I mean, come on.
No, it's worse than that. It's
is it a juice fast, like the megachurch preacher I once...
Is it a juice fast?
You can have one meal and two snacks that don't add up to a full meal.
Okay, that doesn't sound like fasting.
I mean,
that's in the catechism?
I know.
Like, the catechism I can buy at Barnes & Noble, that's like... number
and,
two B.
By the way, I'm sorry. Do you see how much like of a smarter, more modular
it
religion?
It makes so
is?
Much more sense.
And, no wonder you guys have so many more people.
Also, because they don't tell you how big a meal is. Like for you, if for yeah, you that day right. a meal right, is like
for me
cheeseburgers.
That's like a brisket. That's like a 5 pound brisket.
Then your snacks can each be like 1 pound briskets.
Yeah. No. And we looked it up this weekend because my mom was like, "Do I have to fast?" Because she's 63 now, and apparently it ends at age 59.
If you're over 50 or under 30, you don't have to.
I don't know if that's like depressing for people over 59 or like.
No. My mom was very happy to eat chocolate.
It's like when you join AARP, you get like the no fast Catholic card. So in the first episode of the podcast, I loved it because you guys said in your office that you can get like the ashes for Ash Wednesday in the conference room.
Yeah.
And that every week there's a Wednesday mass and no one knows who. It's like you don't have to go, you can go. But on Ash Wednesday, you kind of have to do the ash. And I was thinking...
evidence.
It kind of reminded me of Tablet. I'm assuming America Magazine is like the Catholic analog to Tablet. That's how I picture it in my head. And I'm just like, the idea that we would go into... Besides like food items, which are always in the conference room, like Jewish food items... I can't think of like an analog
if
for
the
Jews.
Tefillin is like we're laying tefillin today.
They have mass. We have lox. That's the difference.
So how many people in the office go to a mass on Wednesday in the conference room?
A given Wednesday, like 5 or 6.
Out of
30.
And are they kind of like, is it like the same 5? Yeah.
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 And it used to be me. And then I started doing Jesuitical on Wednesdays. And I don't got time for mass.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So speaking of America Magazine.
Yes.
Which we have on the table right here.
Why do we have it on the table, Leo?
We have it on the table, as you could see, by the bottom left-hand corner. Because this year, Leah Leibowitz is a subscriber to America Magazine. Now, here's what I want to know. First of all, am I the only Leibowitz who subscribes to America Magazine?
You are the only living Leibowitz. I went through the records, and there was 4 Leibowitz. Only one of them was active, and it was you.
It's a nice euphemism for alive. That's what
I assume active. The other ones have.
Who are the other 3 Leibovi?
Converts. They're converts. They were hidden in the Holocaust.
Now I'm
raised
serious.
By nuns in the French mountains in the Pyrenees. And
who are your subscribers? Who reads America Magazine?
And if I can actually back up, and the subhead of America is the Jesuit Review of Faith and Culture. Can you explain to our listeners who might not understand what that means? Jesuit? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I feel completely unqualified to give the Jesuit history.
But same for us. So.
No, you're
so
just representing, Jews. You know, the entire... Go ahead.
So within the Catholic Church, there are different religious orders. There are like different teams within the church. So you got your Jesuits, your Franciscans, your Dominicans. And these are orders of religious people who take vows of poverty and obedience and chastity and then have different missions. So the Jesuits were founded in the 16th century by St. Ignatius. He was a Spaniard. He was kind of like a young strapping princeling who got...
He was Inigo Montoya.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Yes,
basically.
Okay, got it.
And he got
you killed my holy father.
Prepare to
be converted at the sword. Right.
Yeah, so he got hit by a cannonball. His like nightly dreams went out the window, and while he was convalescing, he read a book of like the saints and became a devout Catholic.
He was hit by a cannonball.
Yeah,
literally
intense.
Hit by a cannonball, like blew off his
doesn't
leg.
Happen anymore.
Yeah. No. So there's this thing in like Jesuit spirituality called like the cannonball moment, like where something happens in your life and it just like knocks you off your horse, metaphorically or literally, and kind of turns you towards
that's amazing.
God.
Do you ever say like before you do a cannonball in the pool that
is that a joke at Jesuit high school?
I'm sure I'm public school all the way, but I have a feeling it's a thing there.
So just to be clear, the orders are what we often many orders have priests and monks, some have priests, monks and nuns. So like the Jesuits just
they only have men
priests, right?
Yeah.
And they're all priests, right?
No, there are
monks.
Priests and brothers.
Brothers, right.
So the brothers they can't say the full mass, but they have their own place within the order. Yeah. So the Jesuits founded back then have a long and storied history.
Of being the smart ones.
Yeah, being the smarty pants.
Founding,
and that's where
founding
so
Georgetown.
Jesuitical comes from. It was a derogatory term. It was so Jesuits were often in places of power, seen as elite, and would make arguments that some would say were sophisticated but hollow. And so Jesuitical means like equivocating or dissembling. And so with the podcast, we kind of wanted to claim Jesuitical in a good way.
Wow.
You're reclaiming.
Yeah.
So the people who read America are Jesuits or do regular Catholics?
Yeah. Or Jews.
Or Jew.
Yeah. No, our audience is mostly highly educated, civically involved Catholics. So, and they trend older, but we're trying to bring that down.
Which is basically all of the things that I sort of wish I could be, but am not, clearly, and will never be.
Well, that's something I was sort of very curious about, because the Jewish communal system, and between, you know, the synagogues, but also these like more, I don't know what you would call it, like federations and things like that, are obsessed with the millennials.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how do we keep them? How do we engage them? How do we speak their language? How do we get them to click on things and like things? Is that, yeah, is there sort of like a similar thing going on in the Catholic community?
Yes, that is why we founded a podcast.
That's why when 320-somethings came in and said, give us money to a podcast, the old people are like, yeah.
Exactly. See, but that's exactly the difference between, if I may, our sister religion and us. Because for us, there would be like 17 committees and 23 different denominations, and not a shekel would freaking be produced. Would mm-hmm. the actual, you know, Jesuit be like, this is a very good idea. We're accustomed to actually thinking and moving towards targets. Here's money. Go do that. And 3 months later, you will have.
Is that how it went?
70,000
subscribers. I think you're being a little generous to like the Catholic Church in general. I think
I cannot tell you how strongly I believe in the Catholic Church.
Me too.
It will be the last bastion of. I said this to Sorab Amari, who wrote your cover story last month when he was here. I believe the Catholic Church is the last bastion for Western civilization.
Cool.
Liel's about 8 years out from becoming Catholic.
So part of the reason we wanted to start Jesuitical is when you are in your 20s and you're not married, you're kind of in like ecclesial no man's land. Like you're not getting your kids baptized. You're not getting married. You're just kind of unchurched unless you make a very concerted effort to stay in a community. And I think that's it's hard for a lot of 20-year-olds, especially ones who maybe like went to a Catholic school and then graduate and find themselves surrounded in a sea of secular people. So we wanted to be a virtual community for people like that.
So I want to pick up on Stephanie's question and on your
okay,
answer.
But you're
so
not a millennial.
How dare you?
This question comes from a non-millennial.
You're practically old enough that you don't have to fast with one meal and two small meals on Ash Wednesday.
I'm going to be starving that day.
For those 3 hours.
You get a full meal, you get
snack.
To drink, you can do whatever you want.
What's life like for a young believer in a city like New York?
I have kind of lived in a bubble, I would say. So I don't know if I can speak to the wider situation. I live with three Catholics. I work at a Catholic magazine. I have a great Catholic church. So I've kind of like moved just along those stops on the F train for my 4 years in
You have your safe spaces.
Yeah. But I would say it would be hard. Like the times where I have gone to a birthday party at like a like nice New York club, I'm like, oh, this is how the other side lives. But I don't know. I think that also engenders a solidarity with other believers that might not exist otherwise. Like you really have to be intentional about your faith.
One thing that kind of mm-hmm. falls in this, listening to you and reading America, I often feel there's like this inherent tension, and maybe I'm completely imagining this, but between exactly what you're saying now, right? On the one hand, you guys are of the culture of this millennium of this mm-hmm. era, right? And you have a very specific kind of political cultural approach that is very accommodating and embracing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you are people of faith who take their faith very, very seriously. And I'm wondering how you live out that conflict, because there is sometimes, especially I think in kind of like, how would I call it, giddily secular circles, right?
Yeah.
This notion of like everything that's traditional. We're just reading out a letter from one of our listeners, like everything that's traditional is just, you know, dumb and needs to be dispensed with, and there needs to be some sort of, you know, pleasure in disruption and transgression. Like, do you ever find yourself being like, wow, I'm in a no man's land here?
Yes. And my response to that is to, I think we gain believers by attraction more than instruction or condemning. So my approach has always been to be like, I'm going to be joyful and be very open about the reason for my joy is my Catholic faith, among other things, and just have that witness in this culture, and hope that someone down the line will be like, oh, why is she always laughing and happy? Like, there must be something going on there. So that's kind of
she must not
approach.
Be Jewish.
That's very Breslover, right? That's their thing. Is like we have. There's a Hasidic sect where their thing is like
ecstatic happiness.
You are commanded to be joyful all the time. Like you God gave you this.
They
life.
Invented the rave.
Yeah, you just basically did. Be joyful.
Yeah, and I do
the morning
say
rave.
Difference between like joyful and happiness. Like it does have to be much more deeply rooted than just like feeling happy, because of course I don't always feel happy, but I always try to bring joy to any situation I'm in as a way of, you know, bringing Christ's love into that situation. And
do you ever feel, working at the Catholic magazine, hosting Jesuitical, the Catholic podcast, do you ever feel a little bit like people look at me like the religious one? And I mean, you're religious, so mm-hmm. You went to public school. So are you just used to that by now?
Yeah, I've actually been pleasantly surprised by, like, I don't know, I'll post things on my Facebook about Pope Francis or my podcast, and like people will come out of the woodwork from my high school and just be like, oh, this is really great. And I'm like, oh, okay. So it makes me think that there is this longing that is out there, and you just need to meet people where they're at and present the faith in an accessible way. And we might have more luck than others think.
Than the Jews. Before we let you go, one of the privileges that Gentiles of the Week get is to ask us questions.
Okay.
Do you have any questions for this internationally certified panel of Jewish experts?
I do. I'm wondering how Jewish people learn about Christianity, like either when they're younger or in their college years. Because I feel like for Christians, there's this inherent interest in Judaism because it's where
As
we came
Sean Spicer
from.
Demonstrates.
Yeah. For some Christians, there's an inherent interest in Judaism because, you know, Jesus was a Jew. And so if you want to understand Jesus and Christianity, you kind of have to study Judaism. Is there that same interest in Christianity?
So I think the three of us are going to have very different answers
to
this.
Yeah, especially coming from
Israel.
I will tell you
my answer to that. I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where the Little League baseball teams were organized by parish. Mm-hmm. Like, it was very, very Irish Catholic. And I learned about it from... I don't know what my parents told me. I mean, it was that other thing. I remember on Ash Wednesday getting on the school bus and looking down at all the rows of children with ashes on their forehead. And I remember on Wednesday, the bus would drop. There was a special stop they'd make for CCD, for catechism, right? Like, you could go home or you could get dropped off at your church, the public school bus. So I just knew it was this thing. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Like, there was no instruction. I mean, I absorbed it from the culture. It was like...
By a
but what about
yeah, there's
kids?
Christmas carols. So my kids...
Because that's what I'm curious about, like, how
so
Jewish children
my
are
kids,
learning.
I try to explain to them the story. I mean, they know because they see the Christmas trees and they see... So they know what it is. And I try to teach them a little bit about the theology. And I say they think that, you know, we're still waiting for the Messiah. They think the Messiah has come and his name was Jesus and he was resurrected. And, you know, as I've joked on this show, like, my kids find the resurrection... My kids find the resurrection to be an unlikely story. Like, it's not one that intuitively makes any sense to them, but they
unlike say that parting of the Red Sea.
Yeah, that
the burning bush totally feels well.
Can we do something? Can we bring Rebecca in and actually ask her that question?
Sure. My
I would
daughter's
love
here today.
To know what she knows.
Rebecca?
Yes. Go into the source.
You want to be on the show? Okay.
What kind of liberal father are you? Rebecca, you're on the show. Sit down.
State your name.
Rebecca Oppenheimer.
Okay. Fifth grader.
Who's your father?
Who's your father? Who's your daddy?
Oh.
Oh.
Mark Oppenheimer.
Okay. Okay. Stay on mic. Will you stay on mic? Okay. So Ashley wanted to know. Here, you sit down. So Ashley wanted to know what Jewish parents teach. Seriously, what Jewish parents teach their kids about Christianity? And Liel thought we could ask you what you know about Christianity. So, I mean, and this is not to embarrass you. Maybe you know nothing, which most people don't. So,
yeah. It's talking to the green thing.
Okay. So, I know a lot more from my friends, I think, than my parents, just because, I don't know, sometimes my friends, they'll be talking about, I don't know, Christmas or whatever it is. Or, like, my friend Catherine keeps Lent and she'll say what she'll be talking
she'll
about.
She'll complain about not having sweets.
Yeah.
So who's really? Jesus? What do you know about Jesus?
He was Jewish. I know that. I don't really know how I know that. I just know that. And he...
That's that, more than most Christians know, so that's good.
He lived in Israel, right? Yeah. Okay, so, and the Christians, like, kind of worship him because he, and then he, I'm not really sure what he did, but he was hung on the cross, and then they thought that he was, like, resurrected, and he went, and he was, like, God's son, and then he went up and, like, sat by God or whatever.
And that story seems weird to you. You don't believe he was resurrected?
No.
No.
I have to say, you know a lot about that story.
Yeah, you hit all the major points.
Do you believe the Jewish stories? Do you believe the Red Sea, the burning bush, all the stuff we talked about in Passover?
Not really. Like, I don't believe that, like, the sea, like, actually parted because Moses raised his staff and God parted the sea. But I think it could be ways to, like, tell us things, or it's, like, a moral of the story or whatever is more important than, like, I don't think that God was actually the one that made manna fall from the sky.
Huh.
I think you should lead the Seder next year.
Yeah. I think you should host Unorthodox.
Thanks.
All right, should we wrap up? Thank you, Rebecca.
Wait, but can I give you your presents?
Whoa, all the Gentiles bring gifts.
Oh, my Lord.
It's an Easter basket.
An Easter basket with alcohol.
Mine's pink. Liel's is green. Mark's is yellow. They have eggs.
This is the
personalized
best
alcohol.
Easter Skittles.
I knew to give Mark gin.
Yes.
And Liel,
oh, Tanqueray.
Jack Daniels. But
I
wasn't
got
sure
the party.
About you.
I like
you
that.
You seemed like a rum kind of person.
That's, I like this a
that's
lot.
That's exactly right. Oh my God. This is the nicest. Kit-Kats.
I have to say.
No, I had this like crisis on the train coming over because I was like, oh shoot, Kit Kats are not kosher, but it's only till like sundown
it's
today,
only
right?
Until the end of the day.
I also, thank you so much for this. This is the nicest gift I've ever received.
Thank you so much.
I've always sort of like wanted in on the Easter themed candy, and I've never been able, like, now I have some.
See, now we feel a part of America.
Yeah,
I think Easter has been, ironically, since it's your most religious holiday, it is so thoroughly secularized for us because the eggs and the pastels
and the bunny and
the bunny eggs have jelly beans in them.
Once you throw a bunny in there,
Starburst jelly beans.
I'm in. I have to say, I'm all in. I want to be a Jesuit.
All in.
A Jesuit. Where do I sign up? Okay, Ashley, thank you so much. And if people want to listen to the podcast, how do they get there?
You can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts, Jesuitical, and we're on Twitter at Jesuitical Show. And you can find all of our episodes at americamagazine.org.
And you can also subscribe to America Magazine,
yes,
which is
well worth the read.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you.
I was supposed to have been a Jesuit priest or a Naval Academy. That was the way that my parents perceived me. Those were the plans that they had.
So, Mazel Tovs of the week. Stephanie, do you have one?
So I have like a pre-Mazel Tov to my mom and my sister and my cousin Elizabeth, who are throwing me a bridal shower this weekend. And I think they're doing a lot of work, and I'm uncomfortable by it, but I feel very touched that they're doing it.
So that was a Mazel Tov to the people celebrating you. That
no,
was...
to people doing a nice thing for me.
Okay.
What? That's a thank you. It's a thank you.
Okay.
It's a recognition of what they're doing. You know what? You're just jealous you're not invited.
Just jealous no one throws men showers. Liel?
I have a Mazel Tov.
You have that look on your face like, this Mazel Tov is going to insult somebody.
It is a season of reflection and resurrection. And so my Mazel Tov is to a man I've spent much time denigrating on air. This is to you, Donald J. Trump, for being more of a commander-in-chief in 48 hours in Syria and Afghanistan than your predecessor has been in 8 years. Keep up the good work, my man.
Did not see that coming.
Gotta tell you.
I have credit
where it's due, guys.
I have a triple Mazel Tov. The first is to my niece and nephew, Jolie and Asa Grogan, who read beautifully at the Seder last Friday. Also to their little brother, Gideon, but he's not reading yet. But he behaved beautifully. Second is to Heidi Rabinowitz, who did a very smart interview with us in West Palm Beach. And the podcast version of that, Book of Life, is up on iTunes. You want to check out our podcast, Book of Life. You can find the version, the episode featuring us. And to Linda Magid, who wrote to us, this is just a Mazel Tov for like a great letter. She wrote, I'm listening to your podcast while I assemble my daughter's bat mitzvah invitations. That was a super Jewish thing for you to write to us, and it makes us very happy. And then could we have an extra Mazel Tov since Rebecca is in the house today? Rebecca?
Live from New York. Rebecca Oppenheimer.
You have to get right in front of the microphone. Do you have a Mazel Tov for us?
Can I
Just to my sister, Clara, because she tried to keep Passover and did it really well for the first 2 days. She was really excited that she tried to keep Passover.
How old is she?
Oh, Clara.
She's six.
God bless you.
Awesome mazel tov.
I also want to throw in a mazel tov to Ashley, who brought us my first Easter basket, and I feel like a good American now.
And here's the thing, the most adorable thing, have you seen the little bunny?
Yes, there's details abound.
God, I'm keeping this in my desk.
So
I'm never
much.
Throwing
Me too.
This away.
The Gentiles bring the best gifts.
/ the only gifts.
The only gifts. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson and produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Talushkin. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Lynn Goldsmith of Temple Emmanuel in Dothan, Alabama. Kosher slaughtering is by those who attended the White House Seder. Find Tablet Magazine on Facebook, on Twitter. We're at Tablet Mag. Our music is by Golem. We record in Argo Studios, which is ready to go to war with North Korea. We're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.